Our next speaker is Professor Eileen Barker, Emeritus Professor of Sociology with special reference to the religion from the London School of Economics. Professor Barker is a well-known scholar in sociology of religion, particularly in relation to new religious movement and new religious groups. She was also president of Association for the Sociology of Religion and first non-US scholar who was president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. Professor Barker is also honorary president of International Study of Religion and Central Eastern Europe Association, and I'm very pleased she will speak up about what? Yes.
Thank you, C.D. Shah. I hope it won't be as peculiar as that all the way through, but I like the idea that I've got rights over me. Anyway. So my subject is whose rights trumped whose rights? New religious movements and competing human rights. Now, there are, as we have already heard and will be hearing throughout the meeting, lots of different civil rights issues. Right to exist, equal rights before the law, not to be discriminated against, right to be registered, right not to be registered, right to be a legal entity, right to autonomy in internal affairs, right to proselytize, to free speech, to publish, import and distribute religious material, to assemble, to educate your children, to certain privileges, not to be labelled, and the right to asylum, which is of course very important at the moment. Now, I'm going to spend some time asking the question, what is religion? Not just because it said something about how this would be discussed in the handout we've got, but also because I think it's very pertinent to the situation of new religious movements. There isn't any internationally or even usually nationally agreed definition or understanding of what religion is. And in Vietnam and China and various places in the East, that word was pretty well alien law. Anyway, it didn't exist until comparatively recently. And when I've been in Vietnam, I've been asking about religions and told there's no religion in Vietnam. It's culture, things like ancestor worship, etc. C.E. Yan, who's a Chinese scholar, has made, I think, a useful distinction between institutional religion, which he sees as a system of religious life having an independent theology, independent form of worship, an independent organization of personnel, the clergy, etc. And this he compares to diffused religion, which is conceived of as a religion having its theology, cultus, and personnel so intimately diffused into one or more secular in social institutions that they become part of the concept, rituals, and structure of the latter, thus having no significant independent existence. Now, I'm not going to talk about this a lot, but I think it's quite interesting that a lot of the new religious movements in some sense overlap with the diffused religion or come out of it. There's a whole lot of new religions that come out of popular religion. Perhaps Adam will be talking to us about that. But there is quite a broad stretch. And I will normally be talking about institutional religion, however that's defined. But there's the whole thing about spiritual but not religious, which a whole lot of new religious movements call into. And then people say things like the Sunday Assembly, a congregation for atheists. This meets regularly in London, and it's now spread throughout the world. Is this a new religious movement? Then you get, I don't know how you pronounce Yush, Kim Il-sungism. What is it?
Duce.
Thank you, Duce. Kim Il-sungism. This is a particularly interesting new religion, if you define it that way, as indeed Marxism and Maoism has been defined as a religion. Often religions are something else as well. They're, people will say, oh, it isn't a religion, it's political, or it's business. Well, there's no reason why it can't be both. But now let's ask, what is a new religious movement? What do we mean by new? Do we mean new doctrine, new practice, new structure? The Hare Krishna always get very annoyed with me if I call them a new religious movement, because they say, we're not new, we go back at least 500 years to Lord Chaitanya, if not to Krishna himself. And I say, well, your structure, the institution is new, since it was founded by Prabhupada when he came to America in the 60s. For my work as a sociologist, I find for most purposes, not all, but for most purposes, to call a new religious movement, to define it as one that has a predominantly first generation membership, that is, their converts. Now, this is difficult, and if you want to question me about it, I think I know some of the objections you'll raise, but I think it's more useful than some of the other ways in which it's been defined. And of course, you go to the second generation, but you define second generation new religious movements in relation to the first generation, or the third, etc., going back. And this is interesting because it has, there are certain characteristics that follow from starting from that as a definition. And these can lead us to ask the question, do new religions intrinsically have less right to rights? Have they characteristics that might make one think that they have less right than the rest of us have? Well, the first thing always to say if you're talking about new religions, and I've hinted at it already, is that you can't generalize. In Britain, we have over 1,000 new religions that we know about, and there are tens of thousands elsewhere in the world, and they differ according to every criterion you can think of. They are converts, by my definition. And converts tend to be far more enthusiastic and indeed fanatic than other religions. So they're claiming the rights of God, if we use the first lecture way, in a very intensive way, they know. They tend to be atypical of the population. They don't get a random distribution. And they're rarely people in power. You do occasionally get new religions that come through the upper classes, the Cathars, for example, but not always, or not usually. They tend to have a charismatic leader, founder. And the founders, charismatic leaders that we know about, tend to have been rather nasty, like Om Shinrikyo, or Charles Manson, who is responsible for the murders in the 1960s in California. And we can look at the Branch Davidians, and people think David Koresh was a terrible leader. Of course, what happened in Waco, one can argue, was far more the fault of the FBI than it was of Koresh. That nice gentleman there, some of you may recognize, with those children, that's Jim Jones of the People's Temple. That's David Berg, the one who was responsible for flirty fishing and outrageous things like that, which no longer goes on in the Children of God. In fact, the Children of God per se doesn't exist anymore. So they are associated with bad charismatic leaders. Sun Myung Moon, in the 70s, he won the top poll as the most hated man in America. They tend to have a dichotomous worldview. They know what is right or wrong. They see their behavior as normal and natural, and the rest of the world as unnatural and abnormal. They're good, the rest are bad. They're godly, the rest are satanic. And there's a strong division between us and them, what Mary Douglas calls a strong group boundary. Primary characteristic is whether you are a unificationist, a Krishna devotee, or what have you, or not. And the rest of the world is seen as rather satanic and bad, and there the two shall meet. I am exaggerating. And then, not unlike, surprisingly, they are very often, practically always, treated with suspicion. And this is hardly surprising, because they're the new kid on the block. and people with vested interests, or with children who joined when they wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer and now spend hours on the street, they're not likely to be very pleased. And they're very often scapegoated, and a whole lot of ills of society are plonked upon them. And society itself, parts of it at least, tend to have a sort of mirror image in a way, and again I exaggerate, but they tend to think of the new religions or the sects or cults as abnormal, unnatural, bad, satanic, and them. And they also tend to see this rather homogeneously and lump all the new religions together and think that we are so much better than they are. But does a new religious movement have the right to call itself a religion? And this is what's questioned over and over again. Or, to put the question around another way, does it have the right not to call itself a religion? And a lot of these new religions don't want to be called a religion for various reasons. And there are some very important secular consequences. One well-known case is the Scientologists. When they were founded in 1954 as a religion, people were a bit suspicious. And there's the apocryphal story that L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, said if you want to make money, found a religion. But he was already making quite a lot of money out of Dianetics, but he said he was now a religion. And they fought for a long time to be recognized by the IRS, the Inland Revenue Service in America, so they could get tax exemption. And eventually, in 1993, they managed to get it. On the other hand, transcendental meditation, or the science of creative intelligence, fought in the American courts to not be called a religion, because according to the First Amendment of the United States, it couldn't teach or do anything in the schools or in prisons if it were a religion. And therefore, they were both fighting in the opposite direction, although a lot of people would think that TM, with its Hindu background, was far more religious than Scientology. The question that I've been asked more times than I could possibly count is it a real religion, is it a genuine religion, or is it a cult? And of course the answer to that is it depends what you mean by a cult. A lot of them are, if you use the classic sociological distinction between church, sect, denomination, and cult. But nowadays, people don't normally do that. In popular discourse, a cult is a dangerous pseudo-religion with satanic overtones, which is involved in financial rackets, political intrigues, and dowries in unnatural sexual practices, abuses its women and children, abuses irreversible brainwashing techniques to exploit its recruits, treatment, use sorts of violence, performs humorous and criminal activities, and it's likely to commit mass suicide. Religion, on the other hand, is good and godly. Again, I exaggerate, but this is actually very important. And of course, some cults, new religious movements, do some of these things, but as good sociologists or scholars or just citizens, you have to look and see which do what at what time and which don't do. A new religious movement's legal status may be non-existent, and very often it is. It may be a religious association, it can be a religious group, a religious denomination, a recognized religion, a cult, a sect, a secular organization, a non-for-profit organization, or les dérives sectaires, and there's so much battle about how that is translated from the French, deviant sects. The French language is difficult because it uses sects where the English uses cults and vice versa. But it means bad. Or it could be called, as it is officially in China, an evil heretical sect. And this can affect their right to exist, their right to believe, their right to manifest, their right to associate, their right to proselytize, to own, hire, or rent property, to educate their children, to marry someone, to vote, to have access to law, to move geographically, to have certain privileges, and so on. And you have hierarchies of religions. It isn't always a very neat divide as to who are the goodies and the baddies. It's slightly more complicated. Non-traditional religions are often seen not only as heresies, but they can also be seen as traitors, and therefore they don't deserve full citizenship. They can't be considered to be truly Russian, or truly English, or truly Armenian. A story that I like to tell is when I was in Yerevan, that's in Armenia, Jim, I came back one evening and said to my landlady, and she asked me, I've been to the Hare Krishna temple. And she said, oh, they're not Armenians. And I said, well, they were Armenians. She said, no. And I said, yes, they all spoke Armenian. Their names all ended in I-A-N. They lived in Yerevan all their lives. And she said, they're not Armenians. And I said, why not? And she said, because they're not Christians. And by Christian, she meant members of the Armenian Apostolic Church. So she saw, and this was at the time of the battle in Nagorno-Karabakh, which I'll explain for Jim again, is an Armenian enclave in Azerbaijan. And so actually this was a very important matter and partly responsible for some of the things that you were talking about, the Jehovah's Witnesses. So what do you get if you go to Armenia? I'm only using Armenia as an example. You can find the same thing in a whole lot of other countries. The real Armenians are the members of the Apostolic Church, and then you have other traditional native religions that do exist. And then you have, I can't see what you have then, the Uniates, the Greek Orthodox. Then you have national immigrants from abroad, Armenian churches from abroad, and then foreign traditional religions. And then you can get the 19th century sects like the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists. And right out at the extreme end of definitely not being Armenian or Russian or what have you, you have the new religious movements. They're literally beyond every pale. So another thing is that we shouldn't dialogue with them. I went to a meeting once with the Archbishop of Canterbury and our then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and they were talking about interfaith dialogue and how we must all love each other and be nice to each other. So I asked, well, do you dialogue with new religious movements like Unification Church or Hare Krishna? And they were both a bit embarrassed and they said, well, no, you can't really dialogue with them. We will talk individual members, perhaps, if we've been introduced, but we can't dialogue because that implies recognizing them, and I'm not sure that we want to do that. And you get this in a lot of the interfaith organizations. In Britain, there's the Interfaith Network UK, and it has 9 accepted traditional religions. And the others can't. Actually, there's been a great big fuss about this because they received government funding. And now they have actually included, I think, the Mormons, and they've got a pagan on their committee, which is a big step forward. But they still wouldn't dream of having Scientology. They can't make their own decisions. They're brainwashed. In fact, all cultists are brainwashed. That's the only way you can understand why they are as they are. And as they're brainwashed, we need to rescue them. So we used to have this illegal kidnapping and deprogramming. This is kidnapping taking place in France. It doesn't happen very often in the West now, but it certainly still goes on in Japan, and there is the occasional flutter in the West of deprogramming. Irresistible and irreversible brainwashing. I did a study back in the 70s, probably before most of you were born, about the Moonies, who in that time were meant to be brainwashing par excellence. Everybody knew they were brainwashed, and I found that 90% of those who went through the brainwashing techniques said, thanks very much, we don't want to be a unificationist. And the majority of those who did join left of their own free will within a couple of years. And now, when I'm still looking at them, about 90% of the first cohort of the second generation have left. So their brainwashing isn't terribly efficient. We need to rescue them. We also need special laws to control or ban them. This is a question I asked in the RAMP questionnaire that we did some time ago, Religious and Moral Pluralism. Asked the question, should Jehovah's Witnesses be allowed to practice even if they keep within the law? And 20% said no. Should Scientologists be allowed to practice even if they keep within the law? 39% said no. 17 were non-committal and 45 said that they should. So that was less than half said that as long as they kept within the law, they still shouldn't be allowed. The Hungarians were the most likely and the Dutch the least likely to want to ban both movements. You can ask why. Anyone joining a cult or a new religious movement is likely to be worse off as a result. I asked this of the British. This is a national random sample of the British population. And 40% agreed that they would be worse off, with 35% disagreeing. Now I come to the government reports. All the worry about brainwashing and all the wicked things that the new religious movements get up to has led to a number of government reports. And Jim Richardson and Massimo Intervina have made what I think is quite a useful ideal typical distinction between what they call type one, which are the sort that were produced in France and Belgium. These reports produce lists of sects at the end of the report. I think they had 172 in France and 184 in Belgium. And that included things like the Quakers, certain Baptist groups, the YWCA, for some reason not the YMCA. And these weren't accepted officially, but they have had enormously important consequences in these countries for people not being able to hire, perhaps not get their children into nursery school, because they are on the list. It's led to an inflation of moral panics, and according to Richardson and Intervina, they point out that they say that cults and sects aren't religious, they carry on the brainwashing and the mind control, apostates are seen as victims, and they use the anti-cultists rather than scholars. The anti-cultists being members of organizations that are set up particularly to fight new religious movements, cults, destructive cults. Whereas the type two reports, Germany, the European Parliament, and perhaps the Swedish one, they did use scholars who had studied the movements in their reports. And this led to a greater awareness of the complexity. So that shows that studying cults using scholars is very important. That's meant to be a joke, but nobody laughed. You all know about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We've already had this read to us in the introduction. But what's less often read or used in talks like this is Article 29. Of the Universal Declaration. Everyone has duties to the community in which alone free and full development of his personality is possible. And the exercise of his rights and freedoms, everyone should be subject only to such limitations as are determined by law, whose law, solely for the purpose of securing due recognition and respect for the rights and freedoms of others, which others, and of meeting the just requirements of morality, whose morality, public order, whose public order, and the general welfare, what is that, in a democratic society. Now China agrees with this completely, and this is a statement by Minister Zhu before he went to prison. We must make efforts to create a harmonious society and a good social environment. We must strike hard at hostile forces at home and abroad, such as ethnic separatists, religious extremists, violent terrorists, and heretical organizations like the Falun Gong, who carry out destabilizing activities. 10, okay. Falun Gong, for those of you who don't know, it was a new religious movement. And then Miviludes, which is the French organization, interministerial cult watching group set up by the French. In its report, it says, by giving priority to the aspect of prevention, Miviludes respects its obligations to inform the public about the risks and, in some cases, the dangers to which it is exposed by sectarian aberrations. That's one translation. To promote, while respecting the right of freedom of opinion, the coordination of preventative and repressive action by the authorities to deal with such behavior. So this is their way of protecting their government, their citizens. And this leads me to another distinction that I'd like to make that you find in states. Again, this is very extreme, and you know, there are lots of crossovers, but I think it's helpful to make the distinction. And that is whether you do the control before or after something happens. In the first kind, the before, there's a sort of consumer protectionism ideology. You need special laws related to the sects or the cults. And you get this, for example, in the Abu Picard law in France. And then, as opposed to this, you say, well, we just have the ordinary law, that's sufficient, ordinary criminal law, to deal with anything bad that the cults, sects, new religious movements, or anybody might do. And that you'll find more in England, the USA, and Scandinavia. Here, people are presumed innocent until they're proved guilty. It should be pointed out that even if the law is like that, there can be very arbitrary application. At the time of the deprogramming in America, for example, the police would often take a blind eye when there was the illegal kidnapping going on because they thought the parents had the right to hire somebody in order to kidnap their adult child. Is protection intolerant? Are you punishing wrongdoing, or are you preventing wrongdoing, as the beforeers would say? Are people innocent till they're proved guilty, or should possible guilt be punished? Are you thinking of the rights of the potential perpetrator, or are you thinking about protection of the potential victim? And people can make a pretty strong case for being on the right-hand column. Is it a rights culture or a risk culture? Registration is another issue, whatever they call it that you register. And here there's a lot of discrimination just because of the criteria that are used. For example, the number of members that there have to be in order to be able to register. I think it's 20,000 in Slovakia, which is the top I know of. The time you've been in the country. When the Russians introduced their law about registration, the 15 years went back to the Soviet Union time when you couldn't register anyway, so that ruled out new religious movements. Even, in fact, some like Jehovah's Witnesses who've been around before. Lithuania, some statuses require 300 years. You often get delays. Going back to Armenia, the Faith Church, and in Azerbaijan, groups have told me that they've tried and tried and tried, and they get sent back and told, well, there's a comma there, or you haven't answered this question, or silly little things that just put it all off forever. In Denmark, I asked somebody who was responsible for deciding who could conduct their own marriages and who couldn't, and he said, well, we haven't really got a set criterion, but it does help to be mainstream. And the consequences of this registration, as I've already suggested, can be privileges or restrictions, liquidation, like the Jehovah's Witnesses were liquidated in Moscow. That doesn't mean killed, it just means they weren't allowed to practice. Or re-education, like they do in China with the Falun Gong, Eastern Lightning and various other ones. And of course, as the first lecture talked about apostasy, some of the consequences of that can be pretty dire. Charity law. In England, we don't have registration, but we have something called charity, which allows you to get certain tax exemptions. And I'm going to skip through this, but they've recently introduced principle of having to show public benefit. It isn't enough to be a religion. And this way, they have stopped various movements, particularly Scientology and the Exclusive Brethren, although they now have got charitable status, of being charities. And there are a lot of questions that need to be asked about that. Exemptions, we know that there have been several made. There's the Mormon polygamy decision when it was okay to have absolute freedom about belief, but not about practices. The Sherbert Werner Seventh-day Adventist one, where they introduced the concept of compelling state interest being necessary to stop a religion doing something that it wanted. And then there's the whole stuff about the Native Americans fired for using peyote, which eventually led to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which has had a checkered history ever since. So, can the Seventh-day Adventists claim to have a special day off? The Jewish Sabbath, there was a case fairly recently in England where the Lord Chief Justice had arranged for a hearing of an appeal about something or the other. It was about a road going through somebody's house. And they'd arranged it should fall on April 21st. And when the Jewish applicants said, well, that's one of our special holy days, he said, well, it isn't Easter or anything like that. Any normal person would be able to come. And he dismissed the plea. No compelling state interest, the Sikhs, the Burkas, sometimes yes, sometimes no. The Pastafarians being able to wear colanders and the pictures of their driving licenses. Some of them are allowed to and some of them aren't. With a few exceptions, it would seem that everyone's rights trump those of the new religions, and that isn't fair. But it isn't always clear-cut. These are some of the tensions that exist between different rights, our rights, their rights, choice, duty, individual choice, preservation, rights of the child, rights of the parent, etc., etc., etc. You can read that through very quickly yourself if you want. But there are a lot that are in tension, and it isn't always very obvious which right would trump the other one. There have been a large number of issues involving, wait a minute, whoops, I'm not going to read them out, but I want you to see the number. These are minority religions in legal cases, the subjects that there have been, and it's pretty wide, going to, from breaking zoning laws to terrorism and murder. So the reasons for discrimination can be criminal actions, antisocial behavior at the individual or social level, children, very important, medical, physical, social, and numbers. There have been, according to Stuart Wright and Susan Palmer, 116 raids in the West over the past couple of decades or so. And these have been non-new religious movements, particularly concerned with children, not always, mainly Scientology, but not always. I've got 2 minutes, so they've usually had to say, sorry, we were wrong afterwards, but they do occur and they go on. Some of the subjects, the 12 tribes of Messianic community, they've had their children taken away in Germany, and they're still away because they smack their children. There are a whole lot of custody cases where just because one parent is a member of a new religion, this counts against them for the child custody. Children of God, a lot of child abuse that went on but no longer does. Lots of schools, okay, if they're run by the Church of England. What about the Exclusive Brethren? Very good educational values, but the children, the girls and the boys are separated, they can't eat together, they don't meet with other people, it's exclusively Exclusive Brethren, they're bused there and back. They're not allowed to go on to university. What about the madrasas? We've had a scare about Trojan horses when terrorists are teaching in the schools. What about Mayor Shireen? What about the Jedi Faith School? That says teaching us creationism is one thing, but making us build an ark and design a technology is a bit much. This was a great big issue in Britain about a school. Jim's already talked about raising the flag and the mention of Jehovah's Witness children didn't have to. They've had a lot of trouble with conscientious objections, we've heard. But during the Second World War, thousands of them were killed. Unlike the Jews or the Gypsies or the homosexuals, they could have said, we will obey the state, but they didn't. They stayed in Auschwitz and elsewhere. But what happens when you reach them saying they won't give a blood transfusion to their children? And several people have died. Now, Laurie Taylor, I don't know if she's going to talk about it, but she's written a very convincing or telling, I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced, but she argues that a particular case in Canada was permissible, that the girl should be allowed to die. Christian Science, lots of cases of faith healing where children and adults have died. It's pretty tricky when it comes to children. It isn't. It's a whole lot of Pentecostal fundamentalist Christians. So who trumps whom? State usually trumps religion in a democracy. But of course, religion is state and theocracies. State and traditional religions usually trump new religious movements. They have power, they have the finances, and there are established vested interests. And also they've usually got behind them public opinion, the conventional wisdom found by the media, which like sensational stories. But we can't generalize too much. We have reasonable accommodation, we have compelling state interest, and a whole lot of other ways in which we can get round some of the difficulties and the competing competing claims to rights. And there are times when most of us might think rights that are claimed by some new religions ought to be trumped. But we do need to be aware that new religions tend to be dealt a pretty lousy hand. And there are times when the dealer cheats by labeling, generalizing, selective constructions, and a whole lot of other ways. And that's where social science helps. And those of us who have been studying the new religions for a long time certainly try to at least face up to the cheating that goes on when new religious movements and their human rights are being considered. Thank you.